Welcome to Psychology Has It Backwards. This series will question the assumption that people are psychologically broken and need to be fixed. We will talk about how seeing people as innately healthy will change all of your interactions and outcomes. This is a true paradigm shift, and it simplifies the entire process of dealing with mental distress and allows for more profound and immediate changes.
Hello, and welcome back to Psychology Has It Backwards. I'm Judy Sedgman, and I'm coming to you from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Winter in Pittsburgh. and I'm here and lucky to be here enjoying the warmth of my beautiful and wonderful friend.
Christine Heath, coming to you from Hawaii and the land of aloha.
Yes, a wonderful thing, aloha. So, you know, the last visit we had with you, we were talking to you about judgments and how they're sometimes judgments are misinterpreted to be personal when they're actually just statements of noticing something or seeing something that there's, you love the person, but you don't condone the action.
Concern, yeah.
And you're concerned about them, or you have an obligation, if you're a therapist, for example, to let them know if they're going down a path that's going to get them in jail or something. But, you know, in real life, in ordinary life, too, beyond that, we often just encounter judgment in day-to-day situations. Sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's very painful. And so I'm going to start by telling you a funny example just to kind of get us off on a laugh. But during Christmas, I was at a party, and it was a tree trimming party, and there were just a lot of people there I didn't know, and some people I did know, and so I was just randomly chatting with various people, and I was talking to this one man. It's very nice, and he said something to the effect of, "Well, I've seen you around the gym." He said, "You really work hard with your trainer. You're doing great." And I said, "Yeah, I really love it here. I love the trainers and I love the gym and it's just a great place." And he said, "Yeah." He said, "Well, you look good." And I said, "Well, thank you." And then he said, you know, started telling me that he'd gone back, just recently gone back to college, to graduate school, you know, changing professions. And he was just graduating and he's starting a new profession and he's excited about it. And he said, you know, people laughed at me because I'm so old to be starting. And I said, "Well, how old are you?" And he said, "Well, I'm going to turn 70 next year." And then he went back to the subject of the gym. He said, "That's why I'm going to the gym. I'm keeping myself healthy to keep working." And I said, "Yeah, me too." And he said, "Well, when you get to be my age, I hope you're still going to the gym." And I said, "Oh, it's too late for that. I'm already 80. He said a couple more words and said, "Nice talking to you," and walked off. And it was so obvious to me that, you know, he didn't realize how old I was. And it was dark there. I have to say that at the party. He didn't realize how old I was until I told him. And then, you know, he suddenly realized, "Oh, my God, I'm talking to this old lady about how cute she is," or whatever. And he took off. And, you know, I took no offense because, you know, because I am 80. I've had a lot of years to get used to this. But it's funny because that's just a judgment. In other words, like, we could have been friends. I wasn't looking to date somebody. But, you know, he was like, "Oh, my God, she's going to think I'm, you know, after her or something. I can't do that." He was kind of like baffled and tried to get away as soon as possible. But that, you know, that's an innocent story, but it's kind of funny. Uh-huh. But we do that. We judge people often before we even have a chance to get to know them, or we judge them based on criteria that may or may not be relevant. Mm-hmm. To me, it's no different to think, "Well, I'm not going to spend time talking to an 80-year-old that I thought was less than that because she's old, even though he hadn't noticed it before." Mm-hmm. It's the same as saying, "Well, you know, I'm not gonna, now that I found out that this person is this religion or this belief system, I'm not going to talk to them anymore because, mm-hmm. you know, I don't talk to those people." Mm-hmm. And that's just something that's we don't catch it. Because it looks so real to me, because it's habitual thinking that we do. Mm-hmm. We have thoughts mm-hmm. that keep us from sometimes having adventures in life.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. And so things like, you know, like white privilege, male privilege, all of that is just ways of looking at life through judgments, mm-hmm. right? Because you see yourself as having a special role or a special place. You see other people as being less than, mm-hmm. you know, all the isms are mm-hmm. really judgments that we have about other people for the way they are. Mm-hmm. You know, like you're a poor person, so why would I talk to you? Yeah. You can't benefit me in any way. Or you're a person of, you're a white person, you're a person of color. Like, what do I have in common with you? Mm-hmm. So it's, those are the things that, when people, you know, say judge lest thee be judged, it's kind of looking at human beings as being bad because of, who they are or their lot in life or, mm-hmm. what's happened to them. You know, like I had a woman I was working with, and she had been having a series of relationships that were very abusive to her. And she started dating this new man, and he just cherishes her. You know, he just loves her, and he listens to her, and he finds what she says interesting. And she said to me, she said, you know, my standards for relationships were really bad because I would put up with a lot of really bad behavior. Mm-hmm. You know, like it's just interesting how our thinking, whatever it is, it's just our thinking. Mm-hmm. And it blinds us from seeing through the outside, the body of a person. Like people do that with people that are handicapped. Like they look away from them, or homeless people, they look away from them because they don't want to connect with that person because of their own insecurity, mm-hmm. not because of the other person, but in their mind, it looks like that person is making them feel uncomfortable. Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're trying to get away from in terms of how we look at people, that we can love and care about them no matter what they do. Like I have a family member that puts things on Facebook that I think are awful. You know, like they're very negative and very opinionated and very all those things. So I just don't want to look at that. Right. So I don't pay attention to that, but I still love them and I call them and I talk to them. And it's just something that I think is not very healthy. So I'm not doing that, but you know, it's like we all have ways of thinking about each other that are different. And learning to love somebody, even though they may be different from you, and then taking on your own belief system about why that is really important, because that's what makes things different. We start to listen differently. We start to interact with people differently when you're looking at how your thinking is keeping you from connecting with others.
And, you know, this is a really important topic now because the world is so filled with angst and judgment and hatred of one group for another and so on. And I don't want to get into details, but all of it is just missing the deeper humanity and missing the fact that, you know, one person's torture is another person's. We should do that because they deserve it. And you know, it leads to things that are just horrifying mm-hmm. across the world. I remember I was looking recently at a story about Sudan, and it was just awful how people were treating each other just because they were from different tribal groups. And it's horrifying. Mm-hmm. And I mean, but it's happening all over the world. And part of it is that we are so, as a species, we've somehow gotten ourselves insecure about who we tolerate, mm-hmm. and on a micro level and a macro level. And I remember where I lived before I moved to Pittsburgh. I was talking to a person one time whose daughter was finishing college and was seriously dating someone. Mm-hmm. And she said to me, "I just don't know what I'm going to do." She said, "My daughter's dating a Democrat, and if she marries that guy, I'm not going to be able to have a wedding. Nobody in my family will come." And I said, "Well, how would they know he was a Democrat?" She said, "Well, he says these liberal things. I mean, it's obvious." And I thought, well, they'd already be at the wedding by the time they figured that out. So you're probably safe. But I didn't say that because I could see she was really worked up about it. But I thought to myself, you know, in the whole time that I was growing up, I don't remember ever listening to my parents. I mean, a lot of the years that I was growing up, we lived in Washington, D.C., which is a very political place. And we had a lot of friends who were senators and congressmen and people who had been appointed by one president or another. Mm-hmm. And that never came up in social settings. I'm sure it came up on the floor of Congress and in settings where it was appropriate, but it never, ever entered personal life. Like if you had asked me as a high schooler, you know, well, your father and mother are having dinner with these four couples, you know, what party do they belong to? I wouldn't know. Even though there were people that were over at our house all the time and, you know, we'd go places with them and take little short trips and stuff, I had no idea what party they belonged to. And I think that's an interesting change. Mm-hmm. That we kind of used to leave, I think politics rather than being personal and about the person's character. Mm-hmm. Political differences are just differences. Mm-hmm. They were just differences and you worked it out. Mm-hmm. And I remember hearing somebody on television the other day say, well, we don't compromise anymore because that's a sign of weakness. Mm-hmm. Well, compromise is the only way you can get an agreement settled. Mm-hmm. No, it's not a sign of weakness. It's mm-hmm. a sign of wisdom.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's part of evolution, actually. It's almost like you have to take yourself on a little bit. Yeah. Because your thoughts that you grow up in look so normal. It looks like that's the way life is.
Yeah.
And so you don't really see that you have a bias against a person. You don't see that you have a thought about a person that is of different race than you are, or is a different economic status than you are, or has one arm, or, you know, is whatever. We don't see that. So you have to listen to yourself when you want to turn away from that person, rather than engage with the person. You know, I think that part of what's happening with a lot of people is that there's an evolution happening that we have to say, like, oh yeah, this is bad behavior on you to not include these people or not listen to certain people. You know, like it's not a judgment. It's just like, oh, your thinking is blinding you from that. And that's all it is. It's all it ever is that we have thinking that blinds us from seeing beyond what our belief system is. Mm-hmm. Like I'm sure my dad, when I got married, was rolling in his grave because I married a Democrat, a union man, and a Hawaiian. And he was very, very conservative in his thinking. It was like all those things would have been a negative to him. Mm-hmm. Now, do I still love my father? Absolutely. Do I understand that that was his thinking? Yes. If he was still alive, would I have still married my husband? Yes, I would have. And then I would have had to, you know, like deal with my father and hopefully help him to see it or not. I'd protect my husband. Like sometimes when I go to the mainland, I protect my husband from white comments people make. Like we went to my mother's wedding. She got remarried when she was 76. And we went to the wedding with my youngest son and my husband. And we went into the church basement where they had the thing, and everybody in the room turned around and looked at them because there was no other people of color in the room. And I was like, okay, I gotta like pay attention to what's going on here. And my one of my high school teachers came up to me and said, oh, I see that you brought your muscle with you. And I was like, Okay, so I got to be really careful here because people don't realize that what they're saying is coming from a place of bias, right? Mm-hmm. They're not seeing that they have a thought about other people that comes out in a way that could be offensive to people. Mm-hmm. So those kinds of things, when you understand that people are tricked by their thinking to X degree, you don't take them personally. Right. But you also don't do things that would, you know, would put somebody in the lion's den. Right. At least for me, I just have always done that, because through my years of living with him, people have said things to him you would not believe, the things that people have said to him and treated him differently because he was not white. And I would never have seen that any other way, because it's very subtle, you know, and it says it opens your eyes and then you evolve like, oh, okay, now what do I do? You know, what are my thoughts about people that keep me from enjoying and relishing from a different way of looking at things, a different way of looking at life and being loving with people, or maybe holding people back because I wouldn't consider them for a job or for something else, you know? And it's just kind of taking yourself on a little bit to see how thoughts you have that are negative or are at least like you don't feel, what is it? It's like we feel more comfortable with people that think like us.
Yeah.
And so you don't notice that you're just not comfortable with that. Like there's some things you might not be comfortable. Like I'm really not comfortable hanging out with people that do drugs. And I'm not going to change my judgment about that, right? But we have other ones that are more subtle, that are more ingrained in the years of thinking about people that we don't see. And suddenly, people have gotten a lot more attached to being right about having negative thinking about each other. And it's happening all over the world.
Yes.
And that's really that idea of separate realities, isn't it? That we live in our own thought-created reality, and that reality is all we can see.
Yeah.
Until you wake up on the inside. When you wake up on the inside, then you start to see. There's nothing better than have somebody come up to you and say, you know, Chris, that was really an ism, like a sexism or a racism or a comment that you made. And you're like, what? And then you're like, oh my gosh, it's true. And then you're like mortified for, you know, some time. And then you kind of take yourself by the hand and say, okay, I have that thinking. I need to clean it up. I need to make a change. I need to see how to look at my life differently because I've got this thinking.
Yeah, that it's interesting to me that it's so easy to just live in your own world. It's safe. It's comfortable. You know what to do. You know how to behave. And I remember when I was first married. So my husband was going to be drafted, and he enlisted in the Air Force, and we ended up on the island of Okinawa. Station there. And I went to teach in a school that was, it was run by the School Sisters of Notre Dame. It was an American Catholic school, but all of the students were from all over the Orient because Okinawa was safe. And a lot of people from North and South Vietnam and other places that were threatened in that time of war were sending their kids, if they had friends and relatives on Okinawa, to keep the kids safe. And so we had a lot of kids that were separated from their families who were somewhere else, and also, you know, living usually with people that cared for them and everything. But they were encountering each other in a time of really a lot of differences between people of various Oriental backgrounds. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking, wow, these kids do such a great job of not paying any attention to that. I was so struck by the love that they had for each other and for their teachers, and the teachers are all over the place too. You know, I was an American woman who was married to a serviceman, and there were three or four of us in the school, but most of the teachers were like the kids. They had come from somewhere else to be safe on Okinawa. So we were a true melting pot. But, you know, I remember bringing up, I guess I was teaching civics. One of the things that way everybody gets to teach civics at some point, because it's not a real subject in people's minds. So I was an English teacher, but when they needed a civics teacher, they just threw one of us in there. And so I was talking about, and of course our textbooks, because we were an American school, our textbooks, the civics textbooks, were really hard for these kids because it was all about a country they knew nothing about and really didn't care about. And so we were coming to the part about civil rights. And of course, 90% of the people in that school were people, well, we would call people of color, but they weren't what Americans would call black kids. They would say they were from another race. And we're talking about, you know, what happened in the United States. And somebody said, you know, sometimes I wonder if you guys aren't just crazy. I said, what do you mean? And he said, well, you know, I mean, he said, I grew up in the Philippines and I knew a lot of Americans. I knew a lot of military people. I knew people with a lot of different races and types and everything. And I'm a Filipino. I just figured people are different. You know, we didn't have any thoughts about it. And he said, now you're telling me that there was a time when black people couldn't serve in the military? It's like he wouldn't even let them get killed. He was a kid. He was like asking these questions. And I said, yeah, there was such a time. And he said, yeah, well, you kind of hold yourself up to the world as a certain standard. And I'm wondering now about it. And I said, well, that's why we have these things that change us in our country, is because we begin wondering about ourselves. Mm-hmm. And I think that for a long time, we did wonder about ourselves and we did make a lot of changes. Mm-hmm. And now we're at a period of time when we don't really wonder about, is this really true? Mm-hmm. You know, is it actually true that every person of a certain political party is a child molester? That's out there, you know, that's their philosophy. And I'm thinking to myself, how did we get to this point? And I realize it's because we get so insecure that we hang on to the thoughts that we're used to, mm-hmm. that we find a group that agree with us, and then we stay there, and we don't ask ourselves. We're not thrown into a position like we were in that school, or like many mm-hmm. of us have been over the course of our lives, where you got to get to know other people, mm-hmm. you know, you can't not do that. Mm-hmm. And somehow I just feel like that the work that we do, Chris, to me, is the answer, is for people to just see, look, you know, thoughts are really look real to you. Mm-hmm. And if I've grown up in a household that has thoughts about a certain type of person, mm-hmm. Or a certain way of people thinking about their sexuality, or a certain mm-hmm. attitudes about race or about class or about status or about professions. Mm-hmm. You know, that's just thinking that I took on because it was around me and I didn't know there was a choice.
Mm-hmm. You know, I got a good example of that. When I was looking for a husband, I had this criteria, right? a doctor or a lawyer would be good, but certainly a college educated person, and a person that was, you know, successful at what they were doing. And I'm trying to remember what it was now, but I had
something good looking.
Right. He would want to, you know, do the things that I wanted to do. We'd have things in common. We would, you know, he would be loving to me. Like, I grew up in the 50s, right? So I had all these ideas about romance and relationships that were pretty distorted from the movies, because my dad had a theater. So I went to the movies all the time. So I had this idea about what a man would be like that I would marry. So I meet my husband and he's the opposite of that. You know, he's like working as a baggage handler for the airlines at the time. And he was not college educated. He went to college but didn't complete it. And he was lived a different lifestyle than I thought would, you know, I was like looking for someone who had a nice house already, had himself successful, because I was pretty old. But when I fell into that feeling of love, all of those beliefs I had about what I wanted went out the window. Yeah. You know, like because I knew that the feeling I was looking for in a relationship was what was important. I knew that, but I've had many clients that come in that find a nice person to be in a relationship with, and they don't continue on because they don't meet the criteria of what they think a good partner would be. So it's kind of like we get really tricked by the things that we think. And as we kind of evolve you know, we start to notice more and more in my field, in the field of psychology. You know, it's common to know, I mean, this isn't anything new, that if you have a belief about something, then you shouldn't help that person in therapy. That's a common way of thinking in psychology. So when I was working with women who were sexually and physically abused in the 70s, when I was 14, but no, in the 70s, like, I didn't work with men because I had so many negative thoughts about men and how they treat women. And this was the beginning of the feminist movement, you know, and it's like I had a lot of thinking about that. So I didn't see them because I had this bad feeling. And then when I started learning the principles, I remember one day I was talking to somebody and went, oh, men aren't different from women. They're the same. And from that point on, I could start to see men in therapy and be helpful to them. Now it's half, three quarters of my caseload is men. And it was interesting because now I teach graduate students and I have it's 15 of us that work in my clinic. And one of my staff said that she didn't want to see somebody because he had a drug problem. And I was like, yeah. She says, well, I don't want to work with him until he stops using. And I was like, oh, good thing you're going on vacation, right? Because she just got a thought that, I mean, that's our job really, is to help people to get into a state of mind where they can see that quitting would be a good idea. Not waiting for them to get there and then treating them, right? Right. That's just backwards. But I mean, people have come in with, you know, they're have religious beliefs, right? They're brought up in a certain religion, and then they have to deal with people that are part of the LGBTQ plus community, and they have thoughts about that. Well, it's like that's what I expect of my staff, not to say that they have those thoughts, but for them to recognize that those are thoughts that they have to change. Mm-hmm. That's different than saying, okay, don't work with people from that group because you think this.
Yes.
That's kind of the way the field is, because they don't see that the power of thought and how that can change. So instead of like focusing on therapists, change yourself so that you can help anybody that walks in your door, they say, don't see people that have this or that or the other thing that triggers you. Like, should you see them when those thoughts look real to you? Absolutely not. But it's your job as a therapist to see how to get past your beliefs that cause you to have a judgment about that person.
Yeah. And that's true, especially in teaching as well. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of classroom teachers that have had to really come to grips with their thinking as young teachers, with their thinking about certain types of students or students from certain backgrounds that were, you know, bound to fail or going to be trouble or whatever. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because there's so many stories about what a beautiful thing it is when a teacher just looks at a child and sees a person.
Yeah.
And how much it means to them, you know, and they all have to do it. I mean, either that or they leave the profession, because mm-hmm. you can't have that. You can't be sitting there judging kids before they've even had a chance to be in your mm-hmm. class. Mm-hmm. And, but it's also, there's actually been a study at one point about a teacher that, they did this thing where they leave comments for the next year's teacher in elementary school. And this one teacher was reading through the comments, and she told a story in a class I was doing where the first grade teacher had taken this one child that everybody was kind of worried about and said, I love this little boy. He's so creative, and he's a very deep thinker, and he's going to be somebody someday, but he's very different. And a lot of the kids can't understand it. But I suspect that he's going to grow out of that and become, you know, just a leader. And the second grade teacher had left a comment saying, he's impossible. He's difficult. The kids can't get along with him. He's been a problem for me all year long. Mm-hmm. Now, it's the same kid. And so the third grade teacher, she was telling, she was the third grade teacher. So she read these comments from the first and second grade teachers, and she just decided to dismiss them because she had already seen this young man. He stood out because he was very smart and he was different. But she said, I just loved him right away because he was such an eager learner. And I'm sitting there thinking, oh, this kid's going to be a joy to teach because he just can't get enough. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she had already seen that just from the very first day of school. So she said, I'm just not going to read any more of these comments. Mm-hmm. And she was kind of a lesson she learned is don't take other people's word for it. You know, make your own relationships with people and just see them as their potential and not see them as what somebody else thought of them.
Mm-hmm. You know, we're just about done, but I have this story I want to add before we end. And it's such a hopeful story. I worked with this kid who was very odd. Basically anybody that met him would probably diagnose him as being part of the autism spectrum. You know, he was clueless about how he interacted with other people. He was emotional. He'd get angry, blah, blah, blah. And the school was always trying to talk to the parents about how he needed special services to be because of his autism, and the parents would get very defensive and say, he's not around, and you're not going to treat my kid as a sick kid, and da da da. So, and so he started to see me, and he was clearly having behavioral problems. I mean, clearly he couldn't talk to me, he couldn't look me in the eye, he was forced to come in, it was terrible. But over the years, he got better. And then now he's a senior and he asked to meet with me for the last maybe a year now. And he's actually listened. And so he was still doing his little shenanigans. And the school came again and said, we really think he's got autism. So he comes to me and he says, do you think I'm autistic? And I took a breath. And what came to mind was to say, well, you exhibit a lot of the behaviors that people frequently think are autism, but you have health inside of you and you don't have to be like that, but you're the one that has to change you. And then he made another appointment, which he canceled. And then, maybe a month later, maybe a month and a half later, I'm in Costco and his mother's there and she said, my son has totally changed. He's totally fine. He's got lots of friends. He is interacting in school. He's happy. He's doing really well. And he is just like a totally different kid. And I said, oh, that's terrific. Well, then the husband is there and he comes up to me and gives me a big hug. And he goes, I got to tell you, I was going to take him to the doctor because he changed so much. I thought that he was sick. And then I was leaving, walking out of Costco, and he was there. And he comes over and gives me a hug, like, oh, my God, in all the years I saw him in person or online, he was never, ever showing any sign of love for me, really, connection with me. And I was like, wow. I said, I'm so happy for you. And he goes, yeah, I'm doing really well. And he was literally a different kid. And I walked away and I thought, I got to go back. I said, I got to go back and tell you, you coming up and giving me a hug was the best present you could give. You have never, ever been like that. What a beautiful thing. I'm so happy for you. He goes, yeah, that's true. And you could see he didn't like do it because he was thinking I got to be more loving, right? He just did it because he was in this beautiful feeling. Mm-hmm. So you never know, but you got to let go of your thoughts to see beyond that in everybody.
Well, that is a beautiful story, and it was well worth listening to. So thank you for sharing it.
Okay, everybody. Happy New Year.
We'll see you next week.
Bye-bye.
We hope you heard something new and that you will continue to join us to challenge the prevailing thinking about the possibilities for health in everyone. To subscribe to the podcast, visit our website at psychologyhasitbackwards.com.